Support for this program by the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Experience more than 10,000 years of history and culture through art, dance, film, and more. Exploring your home state is the COVID-safe way to enjoy the summer.
Welcome to Native America Calling. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm Andy Murphy. Today is a special day in Mexico. September 16th is the country's annual Independence Day holiday. It's very much like the 4th of July in America, celebrating the birth of the nation. Similar, too, is Mexico's legacy of colonization and erasure of indigenous people. In this hour, we'll talk about how the relationship between Mexico and its indigenous people changed over time. Stay with us. We're back after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The vice president, tribal leaders, celebrities, and musicians were among those to deliver messages to Native Youth Wednesday, taking part in the Protect the Sacred Native Youth Summit. Their messages focused on civic and political engagement and youth leadership. Speaker Shandine Herrera says her leadership journey was sparked at a young age by her mother, who always helped lend support to others.
I think I've always just strived to be a good community member first and foremost. And so at different stages in my life, that has looked like different things, right? What can I contribute to the environment I'm in? How can I improve the lives of those who are around me and use my talents and my skill set to contribute to my community and the future generations to come? So that is how I view leadership.
Takata Iron Eyes, an environmental advocate, says her youth leadership started by speaking out at public events.
People, I guess, started recognizing, right, those sort of qualities within me. I was 9 years old, and that's just because I was lucky enough to have a support system, right, where that was always very much shown to me and encouraged and affirmed in me that I always had the strength to do whatever I wanted. And my mom took me to this uranium mining sort of conference that this board was having to vote on whether or not they would be putting it in the Black Hills. And she told me I could speak if I wanted to, and I did. And that gave me the courage to speak up again, sort of at different points in my life.
The Youth Summit was a 4-hour virtual event to showcase Native youth resilience and support their leadership journeys. Members of the Native American community in the Kansas City area are gearing up for the 2021 NFL football season, continuing their years-long message to the Kansas City football team and the use of Indian stereotypes and misappropriation of Native culture. Members of the group Not In Your Honor hosted their first demonstration Sunday at the team's home opener. Ashley White was among demonstrators holding signs calling on the team to change its name and end racism.
We're not a caricatured version of people, you know? We're real, living, breathing people. We're not 1800 Wild West, you know, indigenous people, you know? We're not here for your enjoyment. We're not here for your display. We're not here for your entertainment. We didn't even get to exist and be who we were based on our own standards. We've been held by the government standards to justify us as a people.
Fans are banned from wearing war paint or headdresses into the stadium. The group plans to host more demonstrations seeking an end of Native imagery, including in the team's Arrowhead logo and the use of Native terms, and apply the NFL's zero tolerance for on-field use of racial slurs. The FBI and the San Juan County Sheriff's Office in New Mexico are seeking help finding a man suspected of kidnapping a Navajo girl in the Four Corners region. The 13-year-old girl was reported missing Tuesday night. She was found alive at a trading post in Red Valley, Arizona on Wednesday morning. The suspect is described as Native American, in his 30s or 40s, about 6 feet tall, short brown hair, no facial hair. He may be driving a dark-colored four-door pickup truck. He was last seen at an RV park in Kirtland, New Mexico, where he allegedly abducted the girl. Law enforcement officers say they're actively searching, but they need the public's help. Anyone with information is asked to contact the FBI. Navajo officers are also assisting with the investigation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for nearly 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. Today is the day Mexico celebrates its independence from Spain. It's not the date, nearly 200 years ago, that the country won independence. Instead, September 16th is the date that Father Miguel Hidalgo rallied oppressed townspeople and called for independence in a rousing speech that touched off an 11-year war of independence. Mexican leaders recite this speech every year. The date is similar to the 4th of July here in America, and just like in America, Mexican indigenous people and the country's violent colonial history is left out of the festive narrative. So despite the celebrations, indigenous people are still fighting for self-determination, land, and culture. In this hour, we'll talk about how the relationship between indigenous people and Mexico has changed over time. You can join us too. How do you identify similarities between the treatment of indigenous people on both sides of the border by Western governments? If you're indigenous from Mexico, how do you feel about today's Independence Day holiday? Join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And joining us on Skype, joining us from Skype in Oaxaca City in Oaxaca, Mexico, is Biani Matza. She is the Keepers of the Earth Fund Manager for Cultural Survival. She is Ayuk and Benisa. Welcome to Native America Calling, Biani.
Hi, Andy.
Hi. All right. Thank you so much for joining us from all the way in Oaxaca. So Independence Day is today. Are there any festivities going on in that area?
Yes. Actually, the celebration is at midnight yesterday. So it's usual for families and people to get together and have some specific meals, and yeah, it's very different in every city in the country because the relationship with the day was different 200 years ago in different areas.
Yeah, and I introduced your indigenous communities, Ayuk and Benisa. Can you tell me about your communities there?
Sure. So there are two completely different cultures. We speak different languages and we have different food, different clothing, different also ecosystems where we live. My Benisa community live next to the sea and we, of course, eat a lot of fish and we are very festive and we wear very colorful clothing. And my community, my Ayuk community, lives in the mountains and we have a very close relationship with harvesting and producing food.
All right, thank you. So How does this day, how do you view this day, Mexican Independence Day? And is that something that Indigenous people kind of have to, weigh on both sides? Is that Mexican pride and nationality and then Indigenous identity and that history back there? How do you feel about this holiday today?
Yeah, it's very interesting. As you mentioned, one is the continuous work of this national pride, and of course a lot of communities celebrate the day because we love festivities, right? We love parties and eat. So a lot of communities celebrate this date, but also at the same time, especially for me and many people, Indigenous peoples, we have this conscious about how was our relationship with the state that was built after the independence, which is not really a safe place for us as Indigenous peoples, and the constant try to erase our identities until today. So it's a mixed feeling, really, because I was speaking with some friends actually, and it's like we have this meal that is special for the day, which is pozole. Maybe a lot of you know it, and it's like we eat the pozole, but like kind of with this conscious idea of, oh, this day is not our day, but we like to eat this food. I don't know if I am explaining myself. It's just a mixed feeling.
Yeah, I think we have that kind of feeling here too in the U.S. On Independence Day. I mean, yeah, we're gonna enjoy those fireworks and we're gonna have that barbecue and have hot dogs, but still, you know, we still have to remember like that history, and as Indigenous people, we have to make sure people know about this history. So it is kind of like weighing two things. Like, yes, we want to celebrate, but at the same time, we're still a little bit angry about what happened a long time ago, and we're still dealing with all the all the effects that are trickling down in our communities and through our families. I know you mentioned it just a little bit, but how has Mexican independence affected Indigenous culture and people? I know you mentioned erasure, but can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. In this idea of building this new state and this new nation known today as Mexico, it needed to erase all the difference within the people and build this new Mexican idea. So by doing that, the state was built to do different projects to build the nation, and one of those, for example, was the Spanish as the main language, and all the education system to make this possible. And by doing that, of course, all the Indigenous languages were erasing until today, constantly not being able to use those languages, but respecting the Spanish as the main language, even though it's not. I think that is a similarity as well with the U.S. It's not that English is the main language. It's just like the state constantly do the work of using it. And that is just one example. And also using the word Mexican just makes and show the idea that we are all the same and we are equal, but we are not. We have a very diverse people, and of course the Spanish people that came, and we have all the slave people that were forced to come here and now are part of this Mexican state, and we have all the Indigenous peoples and cultures that still resist, and maybe a lot of them didn't survive to this state building, this Mexican idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll get a little bit of history just after the break that's coming up right here. But Biani, I wanted to ask you, like, where do you see that turning point in history or maybe contemporary history where you mentioned that, you know, there was a lot of erasure, and now there's some work being done to at least support Indigenous people or not, or just like not have that like active, you know, maybe policy of erasure. Like, where do you see that turning point, and what does it look like now to have folks in Indigenous Mexico revitalizing the culture? Indigenous culture?
Yes, we have a lot of work now. Of course, the communities needed to learn different ways, and by learning Spanish and also being educated, we try to do a different job and focus to keep our languages, our cultures, our rights, especially. So there are a lot of good efforts, and we had forced the state to respect our rights, to include our rights in the constitution, for example, to fund many projects related to language, to territories. But still is an, I can say there is an advance, but also there is still a constant fight to make those efforts possible.
All right. How about politics and community leadership? Is there a movement for Indigenous people to include themselves in that arena?
Yes, and that is a very important question, because many of the traditional governments are collective and very local, and we there is a movement to respect that and to leave the communities to continue with that politics system that is our own. But at the same time, there are other people trying to be part of this state with the democratic system and all that. And there is also from the Indigenous peoples here a mixed feeling, because even though we have now Indigenous peoples representatives of and working with political parties and maybe trying to do a good effort, it's just difficult, because being there and representing the state is just not always the best way, because they need to do other things. And at the end, when they arrive in this positions, they are representing the state. They are Indigenous peoples, but they're not necessarily only working for Indigenous and an Indigenous agenda.
Got it. Thank you so much, Biani. We have Biani Madza here. She is the Keepers of the Earth Fund Manager for Cultural Survival. We'll continue talking with her just after the break, and we'll introduce some other folks who can give us a little bit of history and kind of set up independence and nationality and identity for us. There's a lot to talk about for the rest of the hour, so join us after the break. You can join us too. How do you feel about this Mexican Independence Day today? Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848.
The idea for a center honoring the tribes of Oklahoma started 30 years ago. This weekend, the concept becomes reality as the First Americans Museum officially opens to the public. We'll get the inside story on the long journey from concept to reality and what visitors will find there. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Too many do not have access to affordable high-speed internet. That's why AARP fought for the Emergency Broadband Benefit, a federal program to help lower the cost of high-speed internet for eligible households. Those who may have experienced financial setbacks during the pandemic or are struggling to get by may be eligible for a discount of up to $50 per month for high-speed internet, or up to $75 per month for households on tribal lands. Info at aarp.org/ebb. AARP supports this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. In light of Mexico's Independence Day holiday today, we're talking about Mexican indigenous culture and identity. Do you trace your heritage to indigenous Mexico? How do you view Mexican pride? Join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And right now, I'd like to bring in three more guests. They are actually all from the University of New Mexico. We have Dr. Rhonda Brulat. She is an associate professor of geography and environmental studies and the director of Latin American studies at UNM. Hi, Rhonda.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. We also have Dr. Luis Heran, Heran Avila. He is an assistant professor of history at UNM.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. And then on the phone, we have Moises Gonzalez. He is the associate dean at the University of New Mexico School of Architecture and Planning and the co-editor of Nación Genizara, Ethnogenesis, Place, and Identity in New Mexico. Moises is Genizaro. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you guys for all joining today. So I'd like to start with Luis. We are talking about a lot today, and I wanted to get a little bit of history from you. So how did Spain take control of what is now Mexico, and what kind of movement of people happened back then?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a loaded question because there's a lot of debate, of current debate among historians and also, I would say, in Mexican public opinion, right, about how that happened, right, particularly with the commemoration of the 500 years of the fall of Tenochtitlan, right, of the Aztec Empire. So the Spaniards come to the New World, right, to the Americas, as part of an imperial and colonial project seeking to expand their global influence, to extract natural resources, but also to expand, of course, Catholicism, but also to extract labor, right? That was one of the core tenets of the colonial project. So they come to Mexico in 1519, right? And they arrive and they, of course, find, and we know this story, right? They come and find very advanced civilization, right? A civilization, an empire that has a lot of subjugated peoples around them, right? And this is what the Spaniards take advantage of, right? And ultimately, and this is something that historians have emphasized lately, is that the so-called conquest actually takes place as a sort of collective enterprise between the Spanish colonists and the enemies of the Aztec Empire, right? And this, you know, some people might say, well, this is a watered-down version. This is kind of to put a better face to colonialism. But the reality is that there was indigenous agency in this conflict between the Aztecs and the Spaniards, no? And again, the Spaniards come. They set up a colonial system that is distinct from the one we study in most of other parts of North America, right? It is different to English colonialism. That doesn't make it better, right? There's plenty of exploitation, plenty of violence. There are a series of institutions, and New Mexico is, of course, part of this history, right? Series of institutions like the encomiendas, which are about the expansion of Catholicism, but also the exploitation of indigenous labor, sometimes the extreme exploitation of indigenous labor. So, what happens is, I mean, there is also a lot of, we can say, some kind of myth about the destruction of indigenous cultures, because precisely, I mean, this idea was utilized a lot by activism for a while, but the reality is that indigenous cultures are very much alive both north and south of the current border between the U.S. and Mexico, right? So, I mean, newer histories of this period, what they tried to emphasize is that there was indigenous resistance to this destruction, and that there were attempts to preserve cultures and practices and communities by transforming them and integrating, sometimes through coercion, to the colonial system, right? For instance, in Mexico and in other parts of Latin America, indigenous elites became part of the colonial system, right? This is something also that should be emphasized. You know? So I don't know if that more or less covers how the Spaniards arrived and what they did in that first stage.
Yeah, definitely it does. And so what led up to the war for independence? We just mentioned a little bit of Father Hidalgo in the beginning, and how were indigenous people involved in that revolution, in that war?
Right. So the War of Independence has many factors, some internal and some external. There are many changes happening in Europe, right? There are wars between empires. Napoleon from France invades Spain, creates a crisis in the Spanish Empire. The Spanish Empire was also undergoing several decades of reforms to try to transform the nature of the colonial system, to make it more centralized, better administered, etc. And all of these things affect the Americas, right? There is a common sense idea that the Wars of Independence were just led by the Creoles, right? The elites, the white elites in back then Spanish America. The reality is that indigenous peoples participated massively in these uprisings, right? And I think it's a disservice to indigenous history and to history in general to just say, well, independence was created and accomplished by white elites, right? That's just not the case, no? Indigenous rural communities were central to particularly the first stage of the War of Independence in Mexico. Places like Guerrero were very active, very combative, and with different aspirations, right? There was some idea of kind of a nascent nation, right? A Mexican nation kind of trying to break free from the yoke of colonialism. There were also very present, very material, very real histories of exploitation, right? Of abuse by colonial authorities, of the fact that colonial law in the Spanish Empire supposedly protected indigenous peoples from those abuses, but that those laws were not enforced, right? There's also plenty of activists and leaders in the independence movements in different parts of Mexico that are indigenous and also Afro-Mexican, right? So that's another very important aspect that that folks are now studying and sort of trying to put out there as this is the story that we should be knowing, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's all part of the African diaspora that we shouldn't forget about. I also want to ask, you're talking about different people, different classes of people. So there was a caste system, right?
Mm-mm. Right. So the caste system is another one of those devices that the colonial system used to, keep people in the right place, right? Hierarchies. The reality, though, again, we have kind of the formalities of colonial law and then the realities, right? The reality is that the caste system was very fluid, and partly because, again, it was so difficult to enforce, right? How do you, because it was based basically on ancestry and on sort of this idea of bloodlines, how do you prove that you are, you know, that you don't have, for instance, black ancestry, right? There was not a technology back then to prove that. There were no DNA tests, right? So there was a lot of passing, right? And it was a system that was codified a lot by skin color, or even by by the way people dressed. And it was another way to also refer to class, right? So if we look at the Casta paintings, famous Casta paintings, we see different subjects of different classes and different skin colors, right? But again, the problem was that passing allowed a lot of, let's say, subaltern subjects to subvert sometimes that Casta system, right? And again, talking about resistance and sort of subtle ways in which people did transform or pushed against this colonial system.
Yeah, got it. Thanks. I want to turn to you, Dr. Rhonda Brolat. So we are talking about a lot of movement, a lot of things happening within this 11-year revolution, this 11-year war in what is now Mexico. How did indigenous people kind of get... Or maybe I should start with, you know, here in America, we had reservations and we had there were ways of, tracking who was indigenous and who was not, who was from what tribe and who was from a different tribe. And that, you know, kind of became our identity. I mean, even though it is... translated into a very controversial way of thinking about indigenous identity today, but in Mexico it was completely different. How people were separated and identified as indigenous and not. But how did all of this have an effect on indigenous identity and on Mexican identity?
Well, I think that's a really good point. And going back to my colleague Luisa's comments about the nature of Spanish colonialism, there's a very big difference between the settler colonialism that was the model of English colonialism in the United States versus the kind of the Spanish colonialism, which was earlier and really about control of labor. The Spanish weren't as interested in settling and bringing over their families as they were, harnessing the indigenous labor force to extract resources to go back to Spain, right, under, you know, what we call mercantilism. And one of the things that they did, unlike in the United States, which, you know, the strategy was exterminate or push out indigenous populations into different areas that were not seen as maybe agriculturally viable, et cetera. In Mexico, in order to harness labor and subjugate labor, they essentially let indigenous communities stay intact. And that was a really important part. And they maintained their structure. Oftentimes, the ruling peoples in a community were recognized as nobility by the Spanish. And so they maintained a communal identity that was not maintained in the same way in the United States. And as with that goes, you know, a lot of customs around governance, food practices, kinship structures, all the things that, you know, goes into making somebody's sense of self and sense of community. And I think that played a big role. And particularly in some areas of Mexico, which today we might describe as more heavily indigenous or more densely populated by different indigenous groups, a lot of that has to do also with geography, topography. Many of these communities are in fairly rural, mountainous areas, and so they have been able to maintain, a lot of their linguistic heritage and other forms of community life that if they had been in another part of the country that had more developed infrastructure, they may not have maintained the degree that they do. Oaxaca, for example, where our other guest is from, that is one of the most linguistically diverse places in Mexico, around 13 different indigenous languages and hundreds of dialects are spoken. And so I think the way that Spanish colonialism operated by allowing communities to stay intact for exploitative reasons had the effect of creating sort of community-based identities that even today are actually maybe more community-focused than ethnically or racially focused. I know in Oaxaca, many communities don't necessarily identify as indigenous per se or as a particular indigenous group. Some do, but oftentimes people will identify with being from a particular place. So it's a very place-based indigeneity in many cases.
Got it. Thanks. So you were talking about, it kind of seems like you're talking about two separate times when Spain had control of the area and then when Mexico had control of the area. When Mexico won independence, what did that change in indigeneity?
That's a great question. You know, one of the things that historians have noted about the move for independence was the way in which criollos or Creoles, as Luis mentioned, one of the sort of banners of their fight for independence was the image of Juan Diego, who was the first indigenous saint of the Americas, who in 1531 had a apparition of saw an apparition of the Virgen de Guadalupe, which is one of the national symbols of Mexico. And Juan Diego was described as a dark-skinned indigenous person. And this symbol, which is you can see throughout Mexico today, of Juan Diego opening his cape and the Virgin appearing in these beautiful roses, that was one of the banners of the independence movement. And so in a sense, the people that were fighting for independence, the European-blooded folks, realized that they needed to tap into a growing population of indigenous and mixed indigenous peoples to unite them under the banner of an independent Mexican nation.
Got it. And that translates to Our Lady of Guadalupe, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd like to touch on that a little bit after the break because it just is kind of, ubiquitous, I guess. It's a symbol of pride and identity, but it's translated different ways by different communities of people today. So if you want to join our conversation today, we are talking about indigenous Mexican culture and history and pride. And that's up, in front of the background of Mexican Independence Day. We'll be back after this break.
Support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting The Other Slavery, Histories of Indian Bondage from New Spain to the Southwestern United States, a virtual symposium that considers the hidden stories of enslaved indigenous peoples, focusing on the legacy of Spanish colonization in the Americas and Asia and its impact on what is now the Southwestern United States. Available on demand from September 24th to the 27th at americanindian.si.edu.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, and today we're focusing on Indigenous Mexico's influence on Mexican and American culture and identity. How has Indigenous Mexican culture taken root in your tribe or local community? There's still time to join our conversation. We are at 1-800-996-2848. That is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I'd like to bring in Moises Gonzalez. He is the Associate Dean at the University of New Mexico of Architecture and Planning and co-editor of Nación Genazara. Moises, so we are talking about Mexico. And, in Native America, we know some of these borders came way after we had already been living here for generations and generations. So borders didn't separate. How this Mexican Revolution affected indigenous people here in New Mexico, in Arizona. How did colonialism and revolution from Mexico affect tribes up here, and how did it affect your indigenous community?
Yeah, so to give some folks some background, New Mexico was basically the northern borderlands of the Spanish Empire. And so it was one of the regions that was very unstable, so unstable that the Spanish had to make alliances with the Comanche, the Utes, and various tribes to negotiate a way in which other groups such as various Apache tribes, Kiowas, Dene, Navajo, in terms of the skirmishes and attacks and mutual slavery that was going on between all these communities. So New Mexico was basically struggling to survive when the War for Independence happened. The outfall is that that was kind of described by others, but I think there's something a little bit different that happens on the northern Spanish-Mexican borderlands, is that the elite, because let's face it, Mexico's constitution was based on attempting to create a liberal democracy or liberal state, right? And in this was an idea of erasing indigenous people for the creation of a nationhood. The way it plays out in New Mexico is this idea. So it's kind of hypocritical that, you know, the nation of Mexico would do away with slavery when slavery was promoted and facilitated by the Mexican state. And then also, you know, the elite the elite politicians were the Spanish upper elite caste. So the way it affected communities in New Mexico is I'm from the Genizaro community, Carnue. Genizaros were basically captive slaves that were from usually plains tribes such as Comanche, Pawnees, also Apaches, and also Diné, right? Nomadic tribes is a better way to say it. And some Pueblos also landed up in Genizaro communities. One particular governor in the 18th century saw a way to create a borderland around the Pueblos and the Spanish Hispano communities at the frontier of these other tribes, like the Comanche, the Apache, as I mentioned, the Utes. So when Mexico becomes a nation, basically they do away with race and identity. The way it plays out is it's sort of an erasure of Genizaros. Although I'd agree with the other speakers, it didn't erase our agency. We still practice our indigenous customs, beliefs, and live on our in our communal lands, as I do in the community of Carnue and other communities like the Pueblo of Abiquiu up in northern New Mexico. So the way it lays the groundwork, you know, so let's, you know, we think about it, you know, Spain as a colonial empire, Mexico as not an empire, but a colonial state for sure, and the coming of the United States. So because the Spanish had to negotiate between different indigenous groups because of its fragile organization, and then Mexico, basically what they were trying to promote was the elite were trying to promote mining and mining and timber with these large land grants to basically the Mexican elite. And also there was campaigns against the Diné, the Apache, to acquire slaves for sale for the mining and timber operations. Plus, these land grants, these individual communities to elites were also encroaching on Ute land. So it also kind of created a lot of turmoil between Genizaro communities that were getting raided and then also used to have to serve on militias against campaigns that the Mexican government would organize against the Navajo and the Apache. It got so bad that, you know, Genicero Pueblo communities were forced on these militia campaigns and being taxed by the Mexican government that a rebellion on August 10th, 1837, which is ironically the Feast of San Lorenzo, was the same day of August 10th in 1680, right? San Lorenzo Day, where Genicero Pueblo communities organized against the Mexican state. They killed the governor. The governor's killed at Santo Domingo Pueblo. Then Governor Armijo comes back and regains power of New Mexico. And so I guess when we celebrate this day, it's interesting that this Hispanic village at the state fair that's going on, there'll be celebrations of DC Feast de Septiembre, which is the celebration of today. But I still think, you know, it resonates in the memory of our rebellion against Mexico.
Awesome. All right. Yeah. You know, there's just a lot of ways to really think about identity. And I know there are a lot of conversations happening about identity and how all of this history and all of this, mixed history coming from Spain all the way up into Mexico, all the way up here is just, has a really big effect on indigenous identity. And I wanted to go back to Dr. Rhonda Brulat, Associate Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies and Director of Latin American Studies over at UNM. So we talked a while ago, and you focus on contemporary indigeneity. What does that mean?
That's a great question. And I think, as we've noted earlier in the show, it's just like the United States, there's a huge diversity of indigenous experiences in Mexico. And also, I should note that many of the folks migrating to the U.S. from Mexico are indigenous migrants, which often gets erased when they come to the United States and they're lumped together as Mexicans, right? Even though they may not speak Spanish or come from an indigenous community. I think today that is something that is still getting sorted out. What does it mean to be indigenous in Mexico? I would argue that it's maybe not the same set of characteristics that we associate with indigeneity in the U.S., given the really sort of distinct historical trajectories of indigenous peoples in Mexico. We could think about it through the lens of language, speaking indigenous language. Is it, you know, maintaining certain customs and practices? Is it maintaining certain forms of dress? Is it just believing yourself to be indigenous, right? We know that ethnic formation is as much about what people believe themselves to be as what identities are imposed on them from the outside. And I think particularly in the current moment, what we're seeing, I would say since the 80s, 90s, is a global indigenous movement in which, increased communications, the internet, I think of the uprising, the EZLN uprising in Chiapas, right? The Zapatista movement. In large part, the identity of indigeneity tapped into a global movement of indigenous peoples that were struggling for rights, lands, resources, representation. And I think increasingly what you see in Mexico are peoples that may not have strongly identified as indigenous, recognizing themselves, seeing themselves in this global movement. And I think you are seeing the mobilization of many communities around indigeneity in ways that you wouldn't have seen two or three decades ago.
Yeah. I know we're talking a lot about history and how all of that is leading up to our identity, Mexican pride, Mexican nationalism. But, with America having a lot of influence pretty much all over the world, and you know, a lot of influence in Mexico. What kind of American maybe policies or laws or international agreements with Mexico affect indigenous people?
Well, I think probably the most obvious example would be NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was went into effect in 1994. And that was an agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico to facilitate the free trade of across borders, commerce across national borders. And what that did in one area, the agricultural sector, is that it essentially flooded the Mexican market with cheap corn produced in the United States. And many indigenous communities in Mexico have historically and continue to be farmers and produce subsistence crops such as corn, beans, chilies, squash, kind of the traditional foods consumed in the Americas. And the NAFTA going into effect essentially made Mexico an available market to the United States, where corn is produced on a much larger commercial scale, and it's produced much more cheaply. So what you have today is many Mexicans and corn eating corn that is produced in the American Midwest. So the staple food, a food that was first domesticated in Mesoamerica, in Mexico, is now imported from the U.S. Because it's more cost-effective, and that has effectively curbed some of the farming in rural, not only indigenous communities, but many rural Mexican communities, and in part, you know, drives migration. If people can no longer afford to farm, they leave their communities and they look for jobs elsewhere.
Thanks for that. I'd like to go back to our guest on Skype. We have Biani Madza in Oaxaca City. She's the Keepers of the Earth Fund Manager for Cultural Survival. Biani, you're hearing about NAFTA. You're hearing about, you know, all of this history leading up to what's happening now. What would you like our listeners to know about some of the bigger issues that Indigenous people, especially in your area, are focusing on or are concerned about?
Thank you, Andy. And also, it's great to hear the other people speaking here, because I agree with all the information you are sharing. And yeah, it's good to see the big picture. Also for me and for many communities, because usually we think very locally and we do a lot of efforts locally, but it's Mexico being that big is very difficult to see the whole picture and how is affecting similarly to other communities, as was mentioned before. And yeah, NAFTA was one of the, and continues being one of the main problems. And I think a lot of the communities that are, as mentioned, not indigenous, but they continue with the tradition of the indigenous peoples cultivating the land, had been one of the main problems. But also after that, I think the territories, the respect of the territories, is one of the biggest problems we are facing today. And all the being now Mexico and state with the kind of right to and the property right of the land, they can decide what to do with it, erasing many times our own right to manage our territories. And that is a continuous fight with all the mega projects after NAFTA, but also related to it. So it's complicated, but it's very similar, not only with it, the country having mining projects and dams projects, but also within other territories in different countries.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Biani. With the we got like two minutes left in the show, I'd like to just talk a little bit about food and the influence that Mexican indigenous culture has on global cuisine. I'd like to go to Dr. Rhonda Brulat and Dr. Luis Eran Avila for that. Like, what would you like to say about food?
Luis?
Well, one thing that Vianney mentioned is the place that pozole has in this Mexican independence celebration is very interesting, right? Because pozole is also a New Mexican dish. It's a kind of a regional variation, right? And it's a, I think it says a lot, just that shared dish says a lot about that shared history and the fact that the border is a little bit artificial in so many respects. And also should put some rethinking of what it means to be New Mexican, right? Yeah, it's a great, I think, a great point of reflection on that, no? About thinking about, yes, the Spanish influence, but also that indigenous component that connects the two countries.
Yeah, definitely. And go ahead, really quick.
I was just going to say that the indigenous Mexico, people think about, you know, colonization as people coming and imposing things on people, but if we think about it, Mexico actually has contributed to the great cuisines of the entire world.
Thank you. We will be back tomorrow.
The Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention remind you, receiving the COVID-19 vaccination protects you, your family, and your community, and urge you to please contact your tribal or urban clinic to get your COVID-19 vaccination if you haven't already. More information at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show. Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.